He's going to tell us about non-commissioned Hamilton. Carl is currently the Wilfred R. and Anne Lee Conacher Distinguished Professor of Physics at Washington University in St. Louis. He's also Professor of Physics at the University of Heidelberg, and he has or had had till recently professorships at the Imperial College of the Maths and Physics Department. He's been at a number of different institutions over the years. So he was an assistant and associate professor at MIT. He was the visiting fellow at Imperial, professor of physics. Very long list. I said if I read the list, there'd be no time for him to talk. So that's, so I think we'll just move straight on to the talk. Please tell us about non-commissioned Hamiltonians.
So thanks very much for coming and listening. I hope I don't bore you completely. There may be something wrong with the computer because the letters are not quite in the right order. Hang on a second. There we go. So this is going to be a colloquium-style talk. I'm not going to go into technical details. There are lots and lots of papers and lots of technical details that I could talk about. And I'm happy to chat about it with you afterward. I'll be around for a few weeks, so I will sort of give you an overview of this topic. basically, what I'm going to be talking about today is an attempt to extend quantum mechanics into the complex domain. Okay, so mathematicians, you know, first had the numbers on the real line, and they found it very interesting and very useful to extend analysis into the complex domain. And I want to try to do this in physics by extending Hamiltonians into the complex domain. So the point here, of course, is that quantum mechanics is a very, very strange animal. This is what some rather well-known people have said about it. Niels Bohr said anyone who thinks he can contemplate quantum mechanics without getting dizzy hasn't properly understood it. And Feynman said anyone who thinks they know quantum mechanics doesn't. That's what he said to one of his graduate students. But I really like what Schrodinger said. He said, I don't like it, and I'm sorry I ever had anything to do with it. So when you took quantum mechanics as an undergraduate, it was presented to you in a very coherent sort of axiom and axiomatic fashion. You know, you learned to accept certain things which were, very physical assumptions, just like the axioms of Euclid for geometry. And all of these assumptions really read as if they were written by a physicist. You know, the assumption of causality, locality, relativistic invariance, existence of a ground state, conservation of probability, real energies, and so on. All of this, these are very, very physical requirements that a quantum theory should satisfy. But there's one axiom that stands out as being, in some sense, different from the rest, and that is this axiom, the axiom that the Hamiltonian has to be Hermitian. And the question is, what is meant by Hermitian? You know, if you walk up to a guy on the street and you say, I have a Hermitian Hamiltonian, what does that mean? The guy will say, oh, it means that if you take the transpose and the complex conjugate, you get back the same Hamiltonian. That axiom is different from all these other axioms in the sense that it doesn't sound as if it was written by a physicist. It sounds to me as if it was written by a mathematician, and it's a beautiful mathematical requirement because from that requirement, you can conclude that probability is conserved and that the energies are real, but it is, in fact, a very strict mathematical requirement, and I'm going to try to relax that requirement in this talk and loosen that requirement and replace it by one that is much more physical, or at least physical sounding. Okay, so the point of this talk is that Dirac hermeticity, and that's what I mean by transpose and complex conjugate, I'm calling that Dirac hermeticity, is a very strong axiom of quantum mechanics, and maybe it's too strong. Okay. However, it's a very, I emphasize, it's a very nice axiom because it guarantees that the energy is real and that probability is conserved. But the point is that it is a really mathematical axiom and not a physical sounding axiom. Okay? So this is how the story begins. It begins, I think it was in 1994, so this is a long time ago, and maybe even before that, maybe 1993, I was visiting Saclay, and I was chatting with Daniel Bessis, who's a very distinguished mathematical physicist, who was there at the time, and he and Xin Justin had been looking at what is called the Liang edge singularity, which is connected with conformal field theory, and I'm not going to talk about that here. But the conformal field theory that is connected with that is an I phi cubed quantum field theory. And so what they had decided to do was to look at an I x cubed quantum system just to see what happened. Okay? And what they had done is they just looked at it for a few minutes one afternoon. In fact, I think it was the day before. And they had tried to calculate some eigenvalues and numerically, and it seemed as if the eigenvalues that they calculated were real. Okay, of course, you never know if something is real. You know, it might be approximately real. So he said to me, "What do you think about it?" And I said to him, "Are you kidding? This is not a Hermitian Hamiltonian. That's a ridiculous theory." In fact, what I said was, "The way I see it, this theory is crazy." And he said, "You're absolutely right." And he didn't work on it anymore, and Xin Justin didn't work on it. And that was the end. So that's the end of my colloquy. No. Not quite. So nobody worked on it, including me or anybody else, for a long time until about 5 years later in 1998. And I was sitting in a colloquium and at my university, and the colloquium speaker was horrible. I mean, it was one of the worst colloquia I had ever heard in my life. It was not unlike this colloquium. It was really, really boring. And I was sitting there, and I wanted to get up and leave. But I couldn't, because, as I told Lucien, I had invited the speaker. You see, I was... I, at the time, was the colloquium organizer the way Lucien's was. So, and I had to give these introductions the way Lucien did. In fact, Lucien said everything I was going to say, and I don't know if there's much left for me to think. But, so I couldn't get up and leave. And so I decided to escape at least theoretically, and I pulled out a piece of paper and I started to work on a problem, and I said to myself, what problem should I work on? And for no particular reason, this Hamiltonian popped into my head, okay? And so I decided, all right, let's see if I can calculate the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian. Okay, and the first thing I did was to say, wait a minute, this Hamiltonian has a symmetry. It obviously doesn't have hermeticity symmetry. H is not equal to H dagger, but it does have PT symmetry. So remember that P means parity, and under parity, x goes to minus x, and momentum, lowercase p, goes to minus p, okay? And under time reversal, remember that x goes to x, but again, p goes to minus p, because you're reversing the velocity, right? But also, remember that I goes to minus I. This is a Hermitian operator, okay, but this is not. I mean, it's not a linear operator, okay? It replaces I by minus I, so it's an anti-linear operator, okay? So this is parity, this is time reversal, and this Hamiltonian obviously has PT symmetry because under I goes to minus I and X goes to minus X, it goes into itself. So I said, great, it has a symmetry. It's not direct hermeticity symmetry, but it has a symmetry. So I said, let me see if I can calculate the eigenvalues. Now, obviously, you can't solve the Schrodinger equation for this exactly, but you can try to solve it perturbatively. And the idea I used was an idea that I had played with a long time ago, and that was this. If you have a nonlinear problem, you can introduce a perturbation parameter that measures how nonlinear the problem is. So, for example, for this equation, which I've mentioned in the psi course, this is a very famous equation. That is the Thomas Fermi equation, and you know it satisfies y of 0 equals 1 and y of infinity is equal to 0. Okay, and it describes the charge distribution in an atom, and the solution looks numerically like this. Okay, in fact, this is a very, very hard differential equation to solve. You can't solve it exactly, and even solving it numerically is extremely difficult. But you can solve this, you can find a very accurate approximation by just doing a simple perturbative calculation. So you can replace this equation by the equation y prime prime equals y times y over x to the epsilon. And you can treat epsilon as small. Okay, and epsilon measures how far this equation departs from linearity. Okay, so when epsilon equals 0, you have the equation y prime prime equals y. And the solution, we'll call it y0. And the solution, y0, is equal to e to the minus x. Okay, and so it actually resembles this curve. And then you can calculate order by order and powers of epsilon. And on the back of an envelope, you can get the solution to the Thomas Fermi equation accurate to better than 1%. You do it almost immediately. It's very, very easy. Okay, and you can solve all kinds of nonlinear problems. You know, if you're the type of person who likes to solve ut plus UUX plus U triple X equals 0, which is the KdV equation, okay, you can just plug in an epsilon over here, okay, and expand in powers of epsilon. And you notice that at epsilon equals 0, the equation is linear, so you can solve it trivially by Fourier transform. And then you can turn on epsilon order by order in powers of epsilon, and you can find very, very accurate approximations to the solution to this equation. So it's very, very nice, very powerful technique. Wait a minute. You remember, I'm back in this colloquium, okay, this really, really boring colloquium. So the question is, how do you solve p squared plus ix cubed? So the idea is, why not replace that Hamiltonian by the Hamiltonian p squared plus x squared, which is the only Hamiltonian, really, that I know how to solve, okay, and multiply it by ix to the epsilon. Okay? The reason for doing this, you see, is that I can expand order by order in powers of epsilon. And the point is that if epsilon is real, this Hamiltonian is PT symmetric for all epsilon. Okay? It's symmetric under I goes to minus I and X goes to minus X. Okay? So usually when you do, or not usually, but often, let's say, when you do perturbation theory, you may break the symmetry of the problem. Okay, if you try to do something perturbative, the symmetry, that perturbative calculation breaks the symmetry. It might break a gauge symmetry. It might break a supersymmetry. So you have to be very careful. But here we are maintaining the PT symmetry of the problem for all epsilon. Okay, so I did the calculation. I had an envelope, so I just turned it over. And I calculated several orders of perturbation theory. And to my shock, order by order in powers of epsilon, the eigenvalues were coming out to be strictly real. It was really hard to believe. Okay, so you can't imagine how excited I was getting. And I just couldn't wait for this colloquium to finish, just the way you feel the same way, actually. And so I, when it was finally over, I ran back to my office and got onto the computer and started to calculate the eigenvalues. And this is what they look like. Okay, so you notice when epsilon is equal to 0, you have the harmonic oscillator. And the eigenvalues of that are exact. Okay, so this is 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and so on. Those are the eigenvalues of p squared plus x squared. And then as you increase epsilon, the eigenvalues are all real numerically, all of them. Okay, and I was absolutely stunned. That's what I found perturbatively, and this is what I found numerically, and this is quite an astonishing result. And I want to emphasize what it is I'm saying to you. I am standing here telling you that the spectrum of this Hamiltonian that I wrote on the is discrete, real, and positive. And by the way, parity symmetry is broken. Okay? And just to emphasize, I mean, this is a strange result because you might say, hey, wait a minute. What about epsilon equals 2? Okay? Because if you set epsilon equal to 2, you get p squared minus x to the 4. That's a wrong sign Hamiltonian. It's an upside down potential. Okay, the potential looks like this. Okay, that's the arch in St. Louis, in case you. And yes, indeed, what I'm telling you is indeed that even for this upside down, even for the Hamiltonian, H equals p squared minus x to the 4, what I'm telling you is that the potential looks like this on the real axis, but in fact, the eigenvalues are up here, and they are discrete and strictly real and positive. That's what I'm telling you. And this is a really, really strange and interesting result. And I'll make a comment. There's a lot more that I can say, which I'm not going to say in a colloquium setting. But what I'm saying to you is that, in fact, any given Hamiltonian has many different spectra. Many spectra. But the spectrum that I'm picking out by starting with the harmonic oscillator and analytically continuing into the complex domain by allowing epsilon to range from 0 up to 2 picks out the particular spectrum, which is not physically what you would think. It is a spectrum where the eigenvalues are real, positive, and discrete. And by the way, although it's not at all obvious, this Hamiltonian has a broken parity symmetry. So the expectation value of x is not equal to 0 in this case. It's not 0, okay, which is interesting. And the reason that I mention that is because there are a lot of people here who think about the standard model. And it would be very interesting to try to extend some of the stuff that I'm talking about today to a Hamiltonian of the form grad phi squared in quantum field theory, grad phi squared, you could put a 2 if you like, minus g phi to the 4. The reason why this is an interesting quantum field theory is, first of all, because you've changed the sign, this theory, and you can have a mass term if you like, it doesn't matter, m squared phi squared. Without the m squared phi squared, this theory is conformally invariant. Okay. Furthermore, with this wrong sign of g, this theory is asymptotically free. So it is a non-trivial theory in four dimensions. And the expectation value of phi is naturally non-zero. So that's sort of what you want if you're interested in the Higgs particle. And you get an expectation value of phi that is non-zero without having to use anything fancy like a spontaneous symmetry breaking, okay, or a Higgs mechanism.
The value.
Oh, I mean, you still have to renormalize the theory, so you have a renormalization point. Okay? I mean, this is still just the same as an ordinary phi to the 4 theory that has to be renormalized. And that's the theory that sets this game. That's where the mass comes in. Okay? Renormalization point. Okay, so that was the beginning of this work, and this is a little over 10 years old. Since then, I published 7 papers in Physical Review Letters over the years, and I have a couple of review articles, and this work here is very, very important work. I understand Patrick Dory was here just recently. This Patrick and his colleagues, Claire Dunning and Roberto Tateo, were the first to actually come up with a rigorous proof that what I've just said to you is true. Okay, namely that the spectrum is strictly real and positive. And it is a very, very, very long proof. I would love to see a short proof. In fact, if you could prove in one page, the proof is like 50 pages long. And it makes use of very fancy mathematics. But if you could prove in one page that for an Ix cubed potential, just Ix cubed, if you can prove the spectrum is real and positive, you should publish it, because I don't know any short proof. So there have been lots and lots of papers. I think there are something like 21 Physical Review Letters published so far, and a couple of Nature Physics articles. These are just the PRLs and Nature Physics articles that have appeared. This is in 2008, in 2009, 2010. So more and more people are becoming interested. There have been well over 800 papers published so far, and there have been, I don't know, I think a dozen international conferences so far on PT symmetric quantum mechanics, which is amazing. It's amazing how fast physics goes and evolves. Just from a sociological point of view, it's really very interesting. And so there are a lot of people working on this, and
I found this in a Portuguese flight magazine. If you work on PT symmetry, you will be as beautiful as she is or as handsome as he is. I guarantee it. but I don't want to claim to be the first person to have discovered PT symmetry. In fact, it goes way back to ancient times. In fact, it says so. If you see Arcadia, Tom Stoppard said it's only performance art, you know, rhetoric. They used to teach it in ancient times like PT. And he was referring to, first, Ptolemy, who clearly was the principal discoverer of it. And he was followed shortly thereafter by P.T. Barnum. But this is Canada. Do you know who P.T. Barnum is? Most of you probably don't. He's a famous American crook who happened to have run the Barnum and Bailey Circus. So these are some of the colleagues that I've published papers with. And I guess the most distinguished one is probably Michael Berry. We've published about four papers on the subject together. That's Michael Berry with his glasses resting on his tummy. So this is the real Michael Berry. I was invited to, they had one of the conferences on PT symmetry was held in Bologna. And that next to me, by the way, this is Barry McCoy, very, very distinguished mathematical physicist. He's the guy, he was also at the conference. He's the guy with whom I wrote my very first paper in physics, actually. And by the way, the T-shirt that I'm wearing there is this T-shirt. How many of you read Portuguese? Yeah. Oh, a lot of you read. Yeah. So maybe I won't give you the best translation, but it reads, roughly speaking, it says, if PT is in your heart, I want to speak to you. Okay, and of course you know what that means, but we won't talk about that. And that's what's happening here. I mean, obviously you're here because PT is in your heart, and here I am talking to you, so it makes perfect sense. But afterward, I have to say, after the conference was over, I was invited to Florence to give a talk, and so I could not resist visiting the PT Palace, you know. Well, I was going to try to show some practical applications. But I was really impressed. This is not fake. I was really impressed. This past summer in China, there was a conference as well on PT symmetry and this. Okay. This character means, roughly speaking, place. That's right? I mean, that's a toilet place. So the question is, how do you prove that the eigenvalues are real? And I am not going to go over the proof because it would take a long seminar, longer than an hour, to do it right. But I'm going to emphasize that the proof is very, very difficult, and it uses a bunch of techniques taken from conformal field theory, so it relies on the beta ansatz and the monodromy group and the Baxter TQ relation, the use of functional determinants, and it's really a high-powered tour de force, and it's very impressive. The work that Patrick and colleagues did is really impressive work, and that is the first. There were many partial proofs, but that is really the first fully rigorous and complete proof that the eigenvalues are real. Okay. However, I want to go back and look at the picture again because I specifically ignored something when I showed you this graph before. I showed you that the eigenvalues were all real and positive, and they were increasing with epsilon. But what I didn't emphasize was that if you allow epsilon to go negative, something funny happens. The eigenvalues come together, and they become degenerate at a negative value of epsilon, and then they seem to disappear. Well, they haven't really disappeared. What has happened is that they've gone off into the complex plane as a complex conjugate pair. So these two eigenvalues disappear, and these two, and these two, and these two. And these points, these critical values of epsilon in which the eigenvalues become degenerate and disappear into the complex plane, have a limit point at the origin, those singularities. So when epsilon is positive, all the eigenvalues are strictly real and positive and discrete. But when epsilon is negative, the eigenvalues are partly, so for a given negative value of epsilon, some of the eigenvalues are real, but the rest of the eigenvalues are complex. Okay? So I'm going to call this the region of broken PT symmetry, and this is the region of unbroken PT symmetry. And what I mean by that, strictly, is this, that if you look at the eigenfunctions, you solve the Schrodinger equation, you look at the eigenfunctions, in this region here, all of the eigenfunctions are actually also eigenstates of PT. They're eigenfunctions of the PT operator, as well as eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian. And in this region, that is not true. The eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian are not eigenstates of PT. So that's why I'm calling this the region of broken PT symmetry. This is the region of unbroken PT symmetry. And there is actually a phase transition right in between, okay, which I'm going to call the PT boundary, the boundary between these two phases. And it really, strictly speaking, is a phase transition. And I'm just going to this is the key difference between non-Hermitian PT symmetric Hamiltonians and Hermitian ones. If you have a Hermitian Hamiltonian, this is boring because it's always true that the eigenvalues are real. End of story. Okay? But if you have a non-Hermitian PT symmetric Hamiltonian, you can have a region where some of the eigenvalues are complex and another region where they're all real. Okay, with a phase transition between them. And that means that you can do experiments where you might observe that phase transition. You can't observe any such transition in Hermitian system. And one other remark, you notice that at the boundary, that is where you have the harmonic oscillator. That's where epsilon equals zero, and this Hamiltonian reduces to the harmonic oscillator. So that's where the Hermitian Hamiltonians actually live. The Hermitian Hamiltonians actually live at this phase transition. Which is kind of interesting. Okay. So, by the way, I just wanted to illustrate what I meant by broken symmetry. On the streets of Paris, you can see lots of examples of broken. This is a clearly broken PT symmetry. I have to say, before I go on, I Googled the term PT boundary because I thought it was really cool. And it came up with thousands, tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of hits. Because the PT boundary, this is the greatest murder mystery of all time. This is the boundary between the Permian era and the Triassic era. You know, there was a great meteorite that struck the Earth and created a nuclear winter and wiped out the dinosaurs, supposedly, right? And this is the Triassic era. This is the beginning of the age of the dinosaurs. And my favorite animal that lived at that time, I have to tell you, is the pterodactyl. That's no question about that. Okay, so I've emphasized the PT boundary is actually a phase transition, and this transition actually occurs at the classical level. And I don't know whether we're going to have time, but if you're interested afterward, I can tell you about it. If there's time at the end of this talk, I'll tell you what I mean by PT classical mechanics. So PT classical mechanics is itself a really, really interesting subject. I mean, there's lots and lots of work to be done, and very interesting. So that's the PT. That's the classical limit of PT quantum mechanics. Okay, anyway, so I've emphasized that the eigenvalues are real, but you can ask, okay, so the eigenvalues are real, big deal. Does this have anything to do with quantum mechanics? Because quantum mechanics is not just a theory with real eigenvalues. The point is you have to have a probabilistic interpretation, okay? You have to have a Hilbert space, and the dot product in the Hilbert space has to be positive because the mathematical dot product in Hilbert space is associated, has a probabilistic interpretation, and probabilities have to be real. So you have to have a Hilbert space with a positive metric, you have to have unitarity, and so on. And what I have to tell you is, so this is just a, maybe I shouldn't advertise how stupid I am, but I argued, I mean, obviously this is the question to ask, and I argued, you know, if H is equal to H dagger, then, you know, what's the inner product? The inner product, you know, what do you mean by this? Okay, well, this thing, this bra, is this ket dagger. I mean, that's how you go from the Hilbert space to the dual space, and it is precisely the dagger over here. Okay, so I thought, well, it's perfectly obvious. Since HPT is equal to H, so it's perfectly obvious. What we must mean by, you know, by this bra here, is that it must be the ket PT. What else? It's obvious, right? And so I looked at the states of this Hamiltonian. I mean, I showed you the eigenvalues, but we can look at the states. So this is the nth state. And you, with this inner product, you can calculate the dot product of n with m. And indeed, if n is not equal to m, you get 0 for n not equal to m. So I was a very happy puppy, and that's great. Okay. However, if n and m are equal, what you find is that this inner product is minus 1 to the n. Okay, and that's very disappointing because you can't have a negative probability. And so I worked on this problem, I have to say, for a long time, several years. And I thought about it, and basically I decided, or I was on the verge of deciding, that this is hopeless. This is mathematics, but it isn't going to be physics because this is obviously not quantum mechanics. Okay, and of course there are lots of theories that have negative metrics, or non-positive metrics. People have worked on such theories, but this was really very disappointing. And then I have to say, one morning, I was reading a wonderful article that I recommend to all of you. If you have, many of you, I'm sure, have read it. But this is, you know, Dirac invented something called the Dirac equation. Yeah. And he was invited to give a lecture, a public lecture, sort of, on his discovery of the Dirac equation and what it all meant and that kind of thing. And Dirac had, as you know, a very dry sense of humor, drier than dry. And there's a paragraph, a really wonderful paragraph that absolutely inspired me. What he says is, negative energies and probabilities should not be considered as nonsense. They're well-defined concepts mathematically, like a negative sum of money. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? He's really marvelous. Okay, so why is he talking about this? Because when he discovered the Dirac equation, he found that the states, the eigenstates, half of the eigenstates had positive norm, but half of the eigenstates had negative norm. And also half the eigenstates had positive energy and half the eigenstates had negative energy. And this was a disaster. And his real discovery, the real substance of his discovery, is that he fixed it. And the way he fixed it was to redefine the inner product. He didn't talk about psi. When you write down a Dirac field theory, you don't write down psi dagger psi. You write down psi bar psi. That's what you write down. Okay? And the difference between bar and dagger is the C operator, the charge conjugation operator. Okay? And so in order to fix this, in order to convert these negative probabilities into positive, all positive probabilities, he redefined the inner product. Okay? And in redefining the inner product to make all positive probabilities, he discovered that there must be states of the opposite electrical charge to that of the electron, and that was a fantastic breakthrough. Unbelievably clever idea. All you had to do was to change the inner product. Okay? So all of a sudden I said, of course, we have to figure out what the right inner product is. And I'm just going to tell you the answer, because this is a long discussion, but the answer is unbelievably simple. So in honor of Dirac, I'm going to tell you about a new operator, and I'm going to call it C, and it has the same mathematical properties as the charge conjugation operator for the Dirac equation. But here we're just talking about simple quantum mechanics, okay? And C has three simple properties. First, it is itself PT symmetric. That is, it commutes with the PT operator. And secondly, C is a reflection operator, just like charge conjugation, so that C squared is 1. And thirdly, C is a hidden symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So it's not at all obvious, but all of these PT symmetric Hamiltonians have a hidden symmetry, okay? And that hidden symmetry is represented by a linear operator, a linear matrix C, and C commutes with the Hamiltonian. And the recipe is that it's not the PT inner product, that's wrong. The correct inner product is the CPT inner product. So you solve those three simultaneous equations, and you have to find a non-trivial solution. Okay, obviously, one solution to that to those equations is the trivial one, which is 1. Okay, but you have to find a non-trivial solution to those equations, and when you find it, this is the definition of the inner product. And now you can verify that this inner product is strictly positive. Okay? Furthermore, because it commutes with the Hamiltonian, norms are preserved in time. So probability is conserved in time. And so what is happening here is that the Hamiltonian is dynamically determining its own inner product. That's how it works. Okay? So here's a sort of a bottom line. You know, if I had walked in here to give you a colloquium or a seminar or something on general relativity, and if I began by saying we will assume that the metric in four-dimensional space, you know, g mu nu, is this matrix, and I wrote down a 4x4 matrix, you would laugh at me. You would say, you can't do that. You would say, you have to determine what the metric is by solving Einstein's equations. You can't just postulate what the metric g mu nu is. But in quantum mechanics, this is exactly what we do. Before you even see the Hamiltonian, you say the metric, that is the metric not in four-dimensional space but in Hilbert space, is transpose and complex conjugate. And what I'm doing here is allowing the Hamiltonian to determine dynamically what Hilbert space it wants to live in. That is, what is the metric to be imposed, okay? And so you have unitarity. With respect to the CPT adjoint, the theory is unitary time evolution, norms are strictly positive, probability is conserved, and so on, and it all works. So what you've got here is a true quantum theory. So this is not just mathematical fun and games. These are perfectly valid quantum theories, okay? And you can see this. I mean, if you go to Italy, if you go to Pisa, for example, you'll see that they honor this symmetry very much. You know, this is a... All right. So you could say, okay, we have unitarity, but is PT quantum mechanics useful? And in fact, you can do zillions of things with it. It's very interesting, and I'm clearly not going to have time to go into detail on it. But I do want to talk about briefly, very briefly, about two advantages of PT quantum mechanics. The first advantage is that it can be used to revive quantum theories that were thought to be dead, which is very interesting. And the second thing is that it's now beginning to be observed experimentally. Okay, and I have to tell you, I mean, I'm a mathematical physicist, and I come from a mathematical background, and I have never done anything that I thought would ever be observable in the laboratory, and that's laughable. But it's absolutely amazing to me that there are now experiments that have been coming out in the past year, less than a year old, which are observing the PT phase transition and which are actually observing this and in many different fields of physics. So it's astonishing to me that something like that is actually happening. Okay, so here's an example of what I mean by reviving a quantum theory that was thought to be dead. So this was a brilliant idea. This is the Lee model, and it was invented by Lee. And it was a fantastically clever idea. This is at the time when renormalization theory was being developed, and people were doing perturbative renormalization. And what T.D. Lee said was, okay, it's perturbative, but is there a way to illustrate what is really going on in renormalization theory? Can I make a model in which you can carry out the renormalization program exactly and in closed form? And this is an absolutely lovely model. It's very, very simple. So you imagine a universe in which there are three particles, and T.D. Lee called them Vn and theta. Okay? So there's a V particle that turns into an N and a theta, and the N and the theta can turn back into a V. And that's the dynamics. And that's all there is to it. Very simple. And the Hamiltonian is a very simple-looking Hamiltonian. There's the free part of the Hamiltonian, which just counts up the number of Vs and multiplies by the mass of the V and the Ns and the thetas and so on. And then the interaction Hamiltonian is exactly what you think it would be. You create a V and you destroy an N and a theta, or you create a theta and an N and you destroy a V. And this is a Hermitian Hamiltonian, okay? And there's an unrenormalized coupling constant G. And you can go through the renormalization program, and it's very simple. And the renormalization just consists of summing bubbles. But to show you how fast physics evolves, this is amazing, the field in which we live. It's really amazing. 1 year later, Shalane and Pauli wrote a paper in 1955, and they said the Lee model is wrong. It's hard to believe that something that simple is wrong, but they said it's fundamentally wrong. So what did they do? They went through the renormalization program, and what they found, so remember, when you do renormalization, what you want to do is you want to calculate the unrenormalized coupling constant as a function of the renormalized coupling constant. That's what you want to do. The point here is that you go to the laboratory, and you make a measurement, and you determine what the renormalized coupling constant is, okay? And you plug it into this formula. Of course, ordinarily, the formula is much more complicated, of course, okay? And it's only known perturbatively, but here it's known exactly. And you calculate the unrenormalized coupling, and then you take G naught and you put it back in the Hamiltonian, and now every physical quantity that you calculate from here on is going to be finite. That's the whole idea of renormalization. It's a beautiful idea. But the problem is that you notice that there's a critical value of G squared over mu squared, and at this critical value, G naught squared becomes negative. If G squared over mu squared is bigger than 1, then this is negative. How could G naught squared be negative? If G naught squared is negative, then G naught is pure imaginary. You remember what G naught is? G naught is the unrenormalized coupling, and there's an I over here. Okay? So the Hamiltonian is no longer Hermitian, and this is what Pauli and Shalane pointed out, and it's a disaster. And in fact, this is what their paper, this very important paper, was reviewed by Salam. And this is a brief review, but I'll read this, just the last paragraph to you. He says, the authors discovered the remarkable result that if G is greater than G critical, there's exactly one new eigenstate for the physical V particle having an energy that is below the mass of the normal V particle. It's further shown that the S matrix for Lee's theory is not unitary when G is greater than G critical. That's because the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, and that the probability for an incoming V particle in the normal state and a theta meson to make a transition to an outgoing V particle in the new ghost state, this new state has a negative norm, so it's called the ghost state, must be negative if the sum of the transition probabilities for the incoming state shall add up to 1. The possible implication of Shalane and Pauli's results for quantum electrodynamics, where people were afraid the same thing was happening, this is the Landau ghost, where in perturbation theory, E over E naught squared has a behavior similar to G over G naught squared in Lee's theory, need not be stressed. So that's it. It was buried. And, of course, it wasn't really buried. Lots and lots of people worked on the Lee model. This is a half a century ago. Lots and lots of people worked on the Lee model and tried to revive it. And all the famous people that you know have written at least one paper on the Lee model, you know, and Weinberg, when he was a graduate student, wrote a paper on the Lee model. It's a wonderful model to play with, but the model was regarded as dead. And many people tried to revive it, including Pauli and Shalane. Pauli worked very hard on it, and also Heisenberg worked hard on it, and Wick, and Sudarshan, and many, many people tried to revive it and didn't. And in fact, if you read, I love the title of this book. This is Barton's book. It's a beautiful little book on quantum field theory. But it's the title, Introduction to Advanced Field Theory. It's really, that's the title. Anyway, Barton says, a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian is unacceptable partly because it may lead to complex energy eigenvalues, but chiefly because it implies a non-unitary S matrix which fails to conserve probability and makes a hash of the physical interpretation. That's it. It's sort of dead. Okay, and now it's officially dead. That's chapter 12. So, however, PT quantum mechanics comes to the rescue. Why is that? Because the Hamiltonian for the Lie model is a trilinear Hamiltonian. Remember, there was a V dagger and an N and a theta, a trilinear Hamiltonian, multiplied by an imaginary term, looks just like I phi cubed or IX cubed. So all you have to do is take those three simultaneous linear equations and solve them, which in the case of the Lie model, you can do exactly in closed form. You don't have to do it perturbatively or approximately or anything like this. You can solve it exactly, and you can show that the Lie model is a perfectly acceptable theory. What happens at that transition is that the Hamiltonian goes from being traditionally Hermitian to being PT symmetric but non-traditionally Hermitian. But at that point, the C operator comes in and fixes everything, and there's nothing wrong with the theory. So the theory is alive and kicking. Nothing wrong with the theory at all. So what we are doing is ghost busting. These states that were thought to have negative norms actually don't have negative norms. They have positive norms. They only have negative norms if you're using the wrong inner product. Okay? Here's one other example, and I'll go... it's getting a little late-ish, so I'm going to go through this just very, very quickly. But this is a very interesting model. It was proposed also about half a century ago. Pice and Uhlenbeck proposed this model. It's called the Pice-Uhlenbeck model. And the idea is that you obtain a fourth-order field equation, okay? And this is the form of the fourth-order field equation. And we would love it if we could have a fourth-order field equation. Why is that? Because when you take the Fourier transform of the field equation to obtain the Green's function, now the Green's function would not be 1 over p squared, but be 1 over p to the fourth, which would give theories which might have finite renormalization. Okay, they wouldn't have infinities or might have fewer infinities. So that's a really interesting idea. That was their idea, and it's very, very, very cool idea. But the problem is this. If you calculate the Green's function and you get p squared here, it's just e squared because it's just an oscillator model, you can factor the denominator, and then you can write it in partial fraction form. And if you write it in partial fraction form, you see that particles of one mass, m1, are propagating with positive probability, okay, but this is the Lehmann representation, and there's a violation, an apparent violation of the positivity requirement in the Lehmann representation, because this is negative. This comes out automatically when you write it in partial fraction form, so it looks like a disaster, okay, and that's the ghost. And so the Pice-Uhlenbeck model is dead, okay? And in fact, there are two possible realizations of the Pice-Uhlenbeck model. If A1, you know, there are two fields. There's a field and an auxiliary field. If A1 and A2 annihilate the zero particle state, then the energy spectrum is real and bounded below. Okay, but the problem with this realization is that this excited state has negative Dirac norm. So that's very bad. On the other hand, you can take A1 and A2 dagger to annihilate the zero particle state, and now the theory is free of negative norm states, but this realization is really bad because the energy spectrum is not bounded below. So you either violate one or the other, but it looks like the theory is dead, just dead. Okay, but it turns out there could be another realization, and I'm not going to go through this. This is some work that I did with Phil Mannheim, and what we showed is that, in fact, the Pice-Uhlenbeck model is not conventionally Dirac Hermitian. It is PT symmetric, but it's not conventionally Dirac Hermitian. And if you simply calculate the C operator, you find that this state that was supposedly a ghost state is not a ghost state at all. And in this particular case, you can find an equivalent Hermitian Hamiltonian. And this is the equivalent Hermitian Hamiltonian, and you can see it's nothing but the sum of two ordinary conventional harmonic oscillators. And so the theory is perfectly happy and alive, and there's nothing wrong with the theory. In fact, when you do renormalization and you introduce a ghost, Pauli-Villars, I don't think that's a ghost. I think what you're really doing is you're creating, I mean, this is just a one-dimensional model of that, but even in four dimensions, when you introduce a Pauli-Villars ghost, it's not a ghost. I don't think it's a ghost at all. I think what all that you're really doing is creating a PT symmetric theory, and you have to simultaneously introduce a metric, and with respect to that metric operator, for which there's a recipe, the theory is perfectly happy. There aren't any ghosts. The states have positive probability, but you have to redefine the metric. Okay. All right. So the second thing that I was going to mention was the totalitarian principle. This is the second half of my remarks. Gell-Mann said, everything which is not forbidden is compulsory. I don't know if you know Gell-Mann, or some of you do. He really prides himself on his English, okay, and also on his knowledge of languages. He regards himself as a serious academic linguist. But this is terrible, because what he meant to say is everything that is not forbidden is compulsory. So, anyway, this is the thing that really surprised me. So back in 2008, so first of all, let me just say, I am amazed at how smart some people are. When I was at Harvard, the rules were that if you wanted to take a theory oral, if you want to become a theoretician, you had to take a theory oral, and if you passed it, you could do a thesis in theory, but if you failed it, you never had a second chance, okay? To take a theory oral, but they would let you take an experimental oral, which sort of was nasty, I think, to the experimentalists. The experimentalists are really, really, really smart people, and what they did was they read some of the papers that we've written on PT quantum mechanics, and in 2008, there were two papers. One of them was actually the cover article in PRL, where they proposed the possibility of doing experiments to observe PT symmetric systems. And I read the articles and I was really pleased. You know, they really understood what PT was about, PT quantum mechanics, but I didn't really believe they would do the experiment. And then, amazingly, in 2009, a PRL was published. This is late last year, last December, where they actually did the experiment and they observed the PT phase transition. And in 2010, an even better experiment was done. And there isn't any error at all. There's no difference between the theory and the data. It's absolutely amazing. So this is the nicest email that I've ever gotten in my life. It was sent to me by one of the authors on the original, the first experimental paper. And he said, I have some good news. Understatement. I fell out of my chair when I read this. And basically, he's saying that they've observed a PT phase transition, and with luck, they're going to have more experimental results, and really an amazing experience. So I went to visit one of the guys, and this is Greg Salomo, one of the people on the paper. I had to wear a funny hat like that, too. This guy is in the University of Arkansas, okay? And I figured, University of Arkansas? What kind of physics can they do at the University of Arkansas? It's a stupid theoretical remark. And so they have an absolutely beautiful laboratory where the hard part is making the sample, okay? So this is an experiment done with a waveguide. And, of course, I always imagine a waveguide to be a big thing made out of aluminum, you know, in the waves. But these are fine optical fibers, thinner than a hair. Human hair, okay? And they make these very, very clever samples that take months and months and months to design and to prepare. And this is his lab. It's an immense laboratory. And I finally understood why they have such a beautiful lab. I don't know if you can guess why, but someone in Arkansas gave them a lot of money. Arkansas? Bill Clinton? You got it. Okay. When he was governor, that is, he gave them a lot of money. And this is where they design the samples. And this is the actual experiment. Once you've got the sample, the experiment is very, very simple. You create an optical beam here. You send it through this very carefully designed array of lenses that focuses the beam. And the sample, I have to show you where the sample is. The sample is right in front of this piece of aluminum. It's right about there. It's very hard to see. Then it comes out the other side and comes through here. And then you measure the power. And the power goes back through the cable to the recorder. And that's all. You just measure how much power was lost or gained. To show you a close-up, that is the this is the piece of the aluminum. And that is the sample. That's the waveguide. And if you take a closer look, this is my hand. Okay, in case you... And, see? And these are the waveguides that are on this sample. So this is an aluminum gallium arsenide material. And it's very hard to see from where you are, but these are all different waveguides. And each of these waveguides is actually a pair of weakly coupled waveguides. So there's a waveguide right next to another waveguide. So the way the experiment is supposed to work is that in this waveguide, you have gain. And in this waveguide, you have loss. So this is not Hermitian because the wave is gaining power as it goes along, and here it's losing power. But if you balance the gain against the loss, the Hamiltonian that describes the system is still not Hermitian, but it is PT symmetric. And now you can vary the parameters and see if you can find the phase transition. But here's the problem. It's easy to make a waveguide with loss, because all you have to do is just put some metallic foil on the edge of the waveguide, and it sucks power out of the beam. The question is, how do you put power in? They couldn't figure out how to do it. That's very hard. And so what they did was to say, no problem. We'll do the experiment with one waveguide with loss and one waveguide with no gain or loss. Take the data and map the data into the data that you would have gotten if this had gain and this had matched loss. That's the idea. Okay? That transformation of the data is a similarity transformation, which is an exponential. So if there's any errors in the data, you will get, that will magnify the experimental error. This is a simulation of a PT symmetric Hamiltonian, in this case using a classical waveguide system. Okay, it's a simulation. And what they see is data like this. Okay, the blue is the predicted curve. And what they see is this, here's the transition here. And they actually observe it. It's very, very straightforward and very clear. It's not exactly right, and that's because that exponential transformation magnifies the error. And so this point should be on the curve, but it isn't. It's a little bit off the curve. However, another experiment came out this spring, which absolutely blew me away, because these guys figured out this is a consortium of people in Israel and people in Germany and a few people in the U.S. And what was done here was they figured out how to put power into a beam. And it's very beautiful. Their idea was simply that optical fibers go under the ocean carrying, signals from one continent to another. And the power gradually, the optical beam gradually decays. So what you use is an optically active material. Use lithium niobate doped with iron. And now you can pump it. You can send a laser beam perpendicular to the beam, and you get a perfect PT-symmetric Hamiltonian. Not a mapping of one, but a perfect PT-symmetric Hamiltonian. Okay, and this is their Nature Physics article. And they, as they say, we observe both spontaneous PT symmetry breaking and power oscillations violating left-right symmetry. Our results may pave the way toward a new class of PT synthetic materials with intriguing and unexpected properties that rely on non-reciprocal light propagation and so on. And so this is sort of the idea that when you have an optically active material, you have a pumping beam, and that's how you can put power into the laser beam as it goes by. It's really clever, really ingenious, okay? And that's a comparison between theory and experiment, and the comparison is exact. Okay. What's even more interesting is that later in last spring, there were new experiments where they observed the peaky phase transition in atomic diffusion of spin-polarized rubidium. This is a paper that just appeared a few weeks ago on the web, where they observed peaky symmetry breakdown in superconductivity. So this is a generic thing. You know, it's very easy to make non-Hermitian Hamiltonians, and then you can play with them. And if they're peaky symmetric, you can observe the peaky phase transition. Okay. Here's another one involving Bose-Einstein condensates that just appeared on the web just a few weeks ago. Okay, can I have like 3 minutes more just to conclude? Will you be angry at me? Okay, so with just a last comment. The question is, this is the last question. You can ask, okay, but how do we interpret a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian? And this is a strange result that I'm going to talk about, but very, very, very briefly. I'm going to talk about the quantum Bochristochrone problem. I assume you know the word Bochristochrone. Bochristo means fastest or shortest, not fastest, but shortest. And chronos refers to time, shortest time. So the original classical Bochristochrone problem was solved by a number of insignificant applied mathematicians several hundred years ago. And in that problem, the idea is that you have a frictionless wire, and you have a point in space, A and B, and you have a homogeneous gravitational field, and a bead slides down the wire from A to B. And the question is, what is the shape of the wire for fixed A and B? What is the shape of the wire that minimizes the time of flight? That's the Bochristochrone, shortest time. Okay. In fact, in quantum mechanics, that you can have a Bochristochrone, and it's actually much simpler, the idea. So the idea is you pick two states in Hilbert space, an initial state and a final state, and you can ask, is there a Hamiltonian under which the initial state evolves according to the usual time evolution operator into the final state? And it turns out that's a stupid question, because there's an infinite number of such Hamiltonians, and that's not a very interesting question. So then you can impose a constraint. You can say, subject to the constraint that the biggest eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian minus the smallest eigenvalue is a fixed energy omega, which of those, that subclass of Hamiltonians, can allow the fastest possible time evolution? Okay. So, for example, you can take an initial state 1,0 and a final state AB, just a 2x2 problem. And so you can, to solve, but this is a trivial problem. You can give this to a beginning quantum mechanics student. It's just a 2x2 Hamiltonian. You write down the most general Hamiltonian, okay? And all you have to do is to calculate what e to the iht is. Just have to calculate the evolution operator. But you have an identity that e to the I, you write this Hamiltonian as a linear combination of sigmas, okay, and the Pauli spin matrices. And then the exponential of this is cosine times 1 plus sine times sigma dot n. That's it. So you can exponentiate the time evolution operator. And so you write this. This is just a trivial matrix problem. This 2x2 matrix multiplies the initial state and gives the final state. So that's this statement. And the time of evolution then turns out to be this. And now you can try to adjust the parameters so as to minimize the time. That's it. Okay? And if you do that, what you find is, subject to this constraint, this energy constraint, the minimum time is given by a formula that looks like this. So this is energy times time is proportional to h bar times the sine of that parameter. That's it. Okay. So for a special case, if you ask, what is the shortest time it takes to flip the spin of an electron, you have a spin up state and a spin down state. This formula reduces to the statement, the time is equal to pi times h bar over omega. And you might think this is just the time-energy uncertainty principle, but it isn't. It's actually simpler than that. This merely says rate times time equals distance. Pi h bar is the distance between those two states on the Bloch sphere, okay? And omega is the speed of time evolution, and that's the time. rate times time equals distance. That's all. Just that simple. Okay, so now you can say, fine, let's repeat this problem with a non-Hermitian PT symmetric Hamiltonian. So here's an arbitrary, or not completely arbitrary, but a pretty general PT symmetric 2x2 non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. You can see it's non-Hermitian, okay? T, time reversal, is complex conjugation. Parity is that. The energy levels are this, and you can be in the unbroken PT symmetric region. That is, the energies are real if that inequality is satisfied. And here's the C operator explicitly. So you can see it. This is the 2x2 C operator, which you can calculate. And now, in the PT unbroken region, the physical region of PT symmetry, you take the Hamiltonian, you write it as a linear combination of doing, I'm just repeating myself, of the sigma matrices. You exponentiate it, you solve the equation, and what you find is that the optimal time of evolution is zero. So you can achieve faster than Hermitian time evolution by using a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. Okay? So now we get to the bottom line. Okay? So you can say, all right, so what does PT symmetry really mean? I thought this was rate times time equals distance. Okay? And you can't fiddle with rate times time equals distance. But remember that the PT symmetric Hamiltonian determines its own inner product. So in the Hilbert space that is appropriate for the optimal Hamiltonian, it thinks that the spin-up electron, that vector, is right next to the vector representing a spin-down Hamiltonian. They're not at opposite poles of the Bloch sphere. They're right next to each other. So it takes no time to go from one to the other. It takes an arbitrarily short time because they're arbitrarily close. It's not as if you're actually getting faster than Hermitian time evolution. It just doesn't take any time to go there because you're not traveling any distance. Okay? So if I were to say to you, so here's the bottom line. If I were to say to you, what's the shortest time it takes for you to travel from here to Andromeda? So you would say Andromeda is 2.5 million light years away. Fastest I can travel is the speed of light. Rate times time equals distance. Takes at least 2.5 million years. Okay. But if Kip Thorne walked into the room, he would say, yeah, but maybe four-dimensional space is more complicated than that, and maybe there's a wormhole or something like that. And so without traveling, without violating rate times time equals distance, there's another way to measure the distance from here to Andromeda. It's only 10 feet away, so it just takes a few seconds to walk to Andromeda. Okay, so what are we really doing here? This is a little weird, but I think it belongs in a colloquium. So the interpretation is that finding the optimal PT symmetric Hamiltonian is in some sense constructing a wormhole, not in real four-dimensional space, but in Hilbert space, because it's finding the shortest path between two vectors in the Hilbert space. And I would conclude with what Jacques Hadamard said. He said the shortest path between two truths in the real domain passes through the complex domain. And that's, in a sense, what I'm telling you. So here is an overview of my talk. And thank you very much for listening. Question, I can give you a definite answer to your question for the case of finite matrices. Okay? If you have a matrix that has real eigenvalues, then that matrix is either conventionally Hermitian or it is PT symmetric. Okay? So, and those are the only possibilities. So that's exhaustive. Okay? Of course, it's not clear what you mean by parity when you're talking about a 2x2 or a 3x3 or 4x4 matrix. So, you know, the parity operator, so you choose an operator P, which is Hermitian in the conventional sense,
and as the property that p squared is 1. And then you ask, can you find a p such that, if we choose, without any loss of generality, we choose time reversal just to be complex conjugation, can we choose a p such that that Hamiltonian is pt symmetric? And the answer is always. And that's exhaustive. So those are the only possibilities. Now, if we were talking about a Hamiltonian that had an infinite spectrum, and maybe even a continuously infinite spectrum, then I'm not completely sure whether or not that's true, whether there are any other possibilities, and that gets into very subtle analysis, and I'm not sure that I can... I mean, I can tell you what I believe, but I don't know if it's... I'm betting you that the same is true, but I don't know.
The ground state appears to behave differently to the other states.
Yeah. Ground state is very strange. So you're referring to that graph of eigenvalues I showed you. And what is interesting is that the ground state, I'm not sure if you can call it a ground state, because we're no longer talking about a system with all real, you know, all the eigenvalues are real, then the lowest eigenvalue you would unambiguously call the ground state. But if some of the eigenstates have energies that are complex, it's hard to say what you mean. But nevertheless, the continuation of the ground state gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And at minus one, it blows up. And in fact, when epsilon equals minus one, there are no eigenvalues at all. And that's easy to show. Okay. So for that, in that limit, the spectrum completely disappears. The spectrum is just gone. There are no eigenvalues, real or complex. They're just gone.
Sorry, please.
Is this thing restricted to Hamiltonians, or can you use like every observable?
If you like to work on statistical mechanical models and things like this, there are lots of models. People have discovered lots of models which have, for example, a transfer matrix, which is related to Hamiltonian. Isn't that where the transfer matrix is not Hermitian, but where the eigenvalues are real? In fact, I should say, lots of people found examples, without knowing it, found examples of Hamiltonians where the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, but where the eigenvalues are real. And they didn't realize that there's a huge class of such things. They just thought these were weird things. So my old thesis advisor, Titi Wu, my sort of unofficial thesis advisor, who's a wonderful man, was calculating, was working on a problem of hard spheres, okay? And he was calculating the ground state energy of a system of hard spheres of finite radius, okay? It turns out you can calculate the ground state, and it's real, you get the energy. And he intuited, I mean, he's a very, very smart guy, and he claimed that probably all the energy levels will be real. However, he was severely criticized because the Hamiltonian he was working with turns out to be, there's a problem about defining radial observable, you know, radial momentum, and there's boundary conditions and things like that. This is very tricky. And the Hamiltonian is, strictly speaking, not Hermitian. So how could it have real eigenvalues, people said. Well, if you actually go back and look at it, the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, but it's PT symmetric. Okay, there is lots of work on, for example, on Regi calculus, for example. Okay, so the Pomeran is described by an I phi cube. This is high energy scattering, and the Pomeran is described by an I phi cube field theory. And lots of people have worked on these problems, okay? Moshe worked on this. There's Chung-Yi Tan. Many, many people worked on these problems. They discovered that the eigenvalues were real, okay? And couldn't understand why they were real, but it's just because this is just an example of a PT symmetric Hamiltonian. Okay, so there are many, many models
were looked at long before I looked at this, and these are things that I've discovered later on in chatting with people that, you know, so there are many, many examples where you find non-Hermitian Hamiltonians where the eigenvalues are real, and they turn out to be, in all the cases, turn out to be PT-symmetric Hamiltonians. I kind of like the idea of PT symmetry, you know, space-time reflection symmetry. It's very physical sounding.
So I want to understand if everything boils out to quantum mechanics over real Hilbert spaces. Because actually you can see this from the last example. You have an Hamiltonian which is invariant under transposition, which is the composition of the dagger of the joint and the complex conjugation. Mm-hmm. Right? You may have a real Hilbert space that in infinite dimension you cannot see easily that is real. Because, you know, the basis depend on the real basis depends on the Hamiltonian itself. Mm-hmm. And then you should have everything okay because your unit transformation is orthogonal when the eigenvalues are real. Mm-hmm. But you have the problem when you go to the tensor product of two systems.
Yeah.
And here I see only one system at a time. Is it correct? What I'm saying?
Well, I have to think about it. I mean, I'm not sure that I understand what
because
it is.
You can diagonalize a real matrix, symmetric matrix
can
over
just,
a real
can
matrix.
Can I just stop you there?
Yeah.
You know, if the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, then you need not have, you don't necessarily have to have even a diagonalizable Hamiltonian. It can still have real eigenvalues, okay? And in fact, this is what happens in the equal mass case of, I showed you the Pice-Uhlenbeck oscillator, and in the equal mass case, the Hamiltonian still has real eigenvalues, but it's not even diagonalizable, okay, which is kind of peculiar, okay? Okay, so... Oh, no, wait, hang on a second. I think I understand what you're saying. There is no reason, in my opinion, why the expectation value of P or X has to be real, or why P and X have to be Hermitian objects. There's absolutely no reason. And I say this for the following reason. You know, if we were talking about a quantum field theory, say a phi to the fourth theory, you would have some Hamiltonian like, you know, grad phi squared plus some function of phi cubed, phi to the four, something like that, right? And you would have as a quantum field theory, you would have an equal time commutation relation, which is phi commuted with phi dot is I times a delta function in d-dimensional space, okay? If we reduce this to a one-dimensional space-time quantum field theory, then all that happens here is that this becomes P, and this becomes V of Q, or V of X, okay? This is the one-dimensional version of the quantum field theory, and this becomes X commuted with X dot, or P, is equal to I, okay? Now, in a quantum field theory, we don't have any problem making quantum fields complex. And in fact, in the case of a Dirac theory, the Dirac field is a complex field. And so all I'm doing is saying that X here and P, X and P, are simply complex objects. So we're going off the real X and off the real P axis. Of course, in that case, there's a long discussion that we have to have about whether or not X is measuring the position of a particle or whether it's just an operator. Okay, and it's not a Hermitian operator, just an operator. And that's what I'm doing here, okay? It is not required that X and P be observables, because indeed, in the case of a Dirac theory, psi is not an observable. You cannot observe psi. You cannot observe, and also, by the way, phi is not an observable, okay? You cannot observe phi. If you try to observe, you can observe the energy of an electron, okay, as a local object, a local observable. You can measure the charge of an electron. You can say exactly where it's located in space. You can't tell me where the electron is, because if you localize the electron in a box, you've given it, by the uncertainty principle, an infinite amount of energy. Okay, so it pair produces, so it's no longer in the box. So there isn't any, in relativistic quantum field theory, there isn't any reason to think of X and P, which correspond to that, as observables. I don't require that they be observables. They are only observables in quantum mechanics, which is an approximate quantum field theory. It is a non-relativistic approximation to a relativistic theory where they are definitely not observables. So only in the special case of ordinary quantum mechanics can I say that X and P are real and measurable and observables. And so I'm generalizing that to where they're not. That's really all I'm saying. Okay?
Not real. In the sense
real in the sense of Hermitian.
No, I mean real in the sense of symmetric over a real field, like a matrix made of real numbers that is symmetric.
Yeah,
real.
Yeah.
And these are not real. That's right. And these are
not real.
These are not real. These are complex.
To prove it, because you have to find the basis, if there is a basis on which they are real, in the sense that you have a linear combination of real linear combination of these bases.
What you're saying is, can I construct a transformation
right.
which maps these complex objects into real objects?
Right.
The answer is, yes, I can. Okay, and I'll tell you what it is. Okay, it is a similarity transformation, not a unitary transformation. And the transformation is explicitly
this. You
answered
my question.
Okay. So it's explicitly this. The C operator can be written as e to the q, where q is a conventionally Hermitian operator, times p. In the limit as the quantum theory, the PT symmetric quantum theory approaches a conventional quantum theory, q approaches zero. And so c approaches p, so the cpt adjoint approaches the PPT adjoint, so you get just T, which is complex conjugation, and that's the conventional Hermitian inner product. Okay. Now, I take this Q, and I construct the following similarity transformation, E to the Q over 2. And now if I take your X or your P, okay, and I do a similarity transformation on X and P, what I get is a new X and a new P, and these are real in the standard sense that you're used to. These are real
operators.
So that's the explicit answer to what you want to construct.
But it's rather involved, right? It's not that X is real or X
oh, this
or
is
some very
yeah, this is unbelievably complicated, and I can only calculate the Q operator in a small number of cases. The Lie model is one such case, and the Pai-Zumovich model happens to be another case. And in other cases, I can only calculate the Q operators perturbatively. It's really it's a very non-trivial problem. Very, very, very non-trivial problem.
Yeah, I think we're running over. It's a really very interesting subject. You're around for...
Yeah, I'm around for the next 2.5 weeks.
So 2 weeks, so you can
find...
So we'll thank Carl once again.